A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
This podcast is brought to you by Kempower, the reliable, quick, and scalable EV charging solutions for everyone and everywhere. And StarCharge, the largest EV charging manufacturer in the world, and is also a provider of residential and commercial battery storage. This episode is also made possible by the support we get from Fort Collins Kia. If you are in the market for any electric Kia, not only do they never add market adjustments, they will deliver your car to you anywhere in the 48 contiguous states for out-of-spec viewers. More information in the link in the show notes. Hello, friends. It is great to have you here on our corner of the internet that we like to call the Out of Spec Podcast. I'm your host, Francie, and today I am joined again by Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, it's wonderful to see you here today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. And, you know, we got to meet each other and have these podcasts. This is now your second podcast because you reached out because, as your shirt says, you just can't go a day without talking about your electric vehicle, and neither can we. So we're definitely on the same page there. Today, we're going to talk about level two charging, which is a critical part of the infrastructure needed to meet the demands of millions of EVs on the road and growing EV adoption into the future, right? And as you all know, most of the time, your car is sitting, whether it's an internal combustion engine or an EV, it's sitting somewhere a majority of the time in these moments of stillness are not yet, I would say, optimized for EV charging through level two charging, the slower charging, not the DC fast charging, meaning that there is so much potential to offer reliable, convenient level two charging for people at workplaces, multi-unit housing, parking lots, and curbsides. There's lots of parking all over the US, right? And Kelly, you joined me on the podcast the other month or so to dive into the debate of per minute versus per kilowatt hour charging and how perhaps a dynamic option is the best option and that the answer is not as straightforward as you might be thinking. And I will link to that episode in our show notes. So be sure to check that out. And in case folks haven't had the chance to listen to that other podcast or just need a refresher, Kelly, can you tell me again about your background and how you came to know so much about EVs and EV charging?
Sure. I'm a research associate with BCIT Applied Research in British Columbia, Canada, and we do applied research for smart grids and microgrids, and my focus since 2010 has been on electric vehicles, and which turned me into the EV charging guru for our institute, and so that's my background.
2010, that's 14 years. looking into this. And obviously there has been, yeah, like an exponential change in how things were then. You were an early Nissan Leaf driver adopter, right? And that was an adventure in itself, figuring out how to charge on the very, very new, baby-born new EV charging infrastructure in Canada. And I know you had some fun stories for us on the last episode. So definitely go check that out. And are you still driving that EV now? I'm sure folks want to know.
I am. I'm on my second battery on that vehicle. And so the very early EV infrastructure was actually, I would have to consider it more like you would go to a place and find that they had a ice freezer outside at a gas station, and you could unplug that for a while if they didn't notice if you were really low. So that was the early days of Gorilla charging.
Funny, get the freezer. There you go. So level two charging. It's often considered, I think, and the more I've spoken to people that are either creating products for this or just speaking, doing the research on it, that it's a pretty sweet spot for EV owners in terms of charging speed versus accessibility. And could you walk us through kind of the technical nuances that make level two charging both efficient and practical for everyday use, especially compared to other charging levels?
Yeah, so level two charging can be anywhere from 8 amps or 6 amps is the minimum, up to about 80 amps, I think, is the upper limit for level two charging. And that can supply people with several hundred kilometers of range for overnight charging. And for the most part, 90% of the time, that is probably all you need. And the cost implications of charging with level two is way less than trying to use public infrastructure. So if you can plug in at home on level one, if you're only doing a 20 or 30 kilometers a day, that may be okay. If you need to go like 40 or 50 kilometers a day, then you would need to move up to a level two charger. But the price for home charging is still like in British Columbia, it's between 10 and 12 cents per kilowatt hour. And so going to use public charging stations, DC fast chargers, are probably several orders of magnitude higher than that cost. And so if you can do 90% of your charging on level two, that's where you're going to save the most amount of money.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Maybe just in case people don't know, so there's level one, there's level two, and then often you don't hear of DC fast charging referred to as level three, right? Or would you call it level three, or is it just DC fast charging?
So if we go to the SAE's representation, they have AC level one, AC level two, and AC level three. And then they have DC level one, DC level two, and DC level three. But typically, normal people just see level one, level two. Well, the faster one must be level three. And so in the DC charging, we can refer to the 25 kilowatt charging stations as level one DC. The 50 kilowatt to 100 kilowatt are level two DC. And the 350 kilowatts are level three DC fast charging. And so that's the technical differences as far as SAE is concerned. But level three is quite common. And I think everyone understands when you say, oh, he's using a level three charger, that it's fine to say
that. Sure. I think the most important part is that it's AC or DC charging, which are very distinct there. So I think that's the most important aspect of this. Okay. I wanted to kind of start there because I've seen a little bit of a mix of that lately and things that I've been reading. So might as well clear it up with you, of course, Kelly. So as we know, curbside charging is not uncommon in other parts of the world. And this is where literally on a curb, on a sidewalk, you are able to charge your EV. There's an EV charger there so that when you parallel park perfectly, you can plug in and do whatever errands, whatever you want. Maybe you are a street parking person anyway. So can you tell me a bit more about what we see in other regions of the world for curbside charging and give a picture of, okay, let's get out of North America. What's going on? What is curbside charging like elsewhere?
Yeah, sure. In Europe, they've been doing curbside charging for since 2011, I think it started, and it works very well in Europe, where you bring your own cable, so you don't have to have cables attached to these curbside chargers, and that works really well. In North America, they went a different route and decided that the cable must be attached, and I think that was for safety concerns, but that's a long time ago, and I don't remember for sure, but I'm sure it was a safety issue that SAE had said that they didn't want the socket approach that they went with in Europe for curbside charging, and that was the big difference.
That is a big difference, because it means that, well, one, I've seen the ones that are, you know, curbside, maybe on like a street pole or whatever, and there's the cable's there all the time. So that means if the cable is mismanaged, it's mismanaged. If it falls into the sidewalk and gets run over, or falls into the street and gets run over, there just seems to be a lot more opportunity for harm to come to the cable, which of course could render that necessary part of the charging infrastructure useless. Am I right to think that maybe having your own cable is just a clear right answer, or is there a little bit, it depends on the scenario. It's nice to have your own cable, but.
Having the cable attached was a nice feature, but it definitely has too many drawbacks, especially for the operator. I've seen lots of cities that I worked with that wanted to deploy this infrastructure, and they were concerned about the cables being on the ground, as you said, but they were looking at from a liability perspective. If someone were to walk by and trip on the cable, they didn't want to be liable for it. So then you had to put the cable retainers to hold the cable up, and then you would pull the cable down to plug into your car, and that can work okay in some scenarios, but in other scenarios, the cable is pulled very far and actually puts a lot of torque on your charging port and the cable. The cable would get damaged just by the amount of torque of the cable retainer trying to pull it back to the base location. Mm. So the issues of the cable being run over, being damaged, but it also has an issue of copper thieves would come along and cut the cable off for the $3 or $4 worth of copper in the wires, and then cost the operator $500 or $600 to replace that cable, and it may be out of order for a month or 2 months, depending on how diligent they were at wanting to replace it. And if the charger was in a nice quiet location, the copper thieves would come back as soon as it was replaced. Mm-hmm. And I've seen places that just gave up and pulled out the charger because they were spending too much on cable replacements.
Yeah, that is obviously a cost. And also, audience, if you hear a little bit of adorable snoring, that is Kelly's dog that is sleeping at his feet, I'm sure, which my mom's pug does the same thing. And growing up with pugs, it's definitely a lullaby to me. So just by the way, if you can hear that. So, okay. One aspect, right, you're able to have this detachable cable, but then I also think of different models where where's the energy coming from? Is there any distinctions between, you know, Europe, for instance, being able to launch this one, you have your own detachable cables, but also is there something in the source of the energy that has distinguished their success in making this more widespread compared to North America?
Sure. In Europe, they generally run everything on line-to-line voltage, so 220 or 240 volts is the typical power. So it was quite easy for them to adapt to saying, oh, we're going to run off of our streetlight infrastructure, which is 240 volts or 220 volt. And in North America, the streetlights are generally 120 volts, so it just people just assume that, well, we don't want to run level one on the streetlight charging, so that was an issue for North America to get over. They thought it was only going to be level one on the streetlights.
Okay, interesting. So There's a couple of different things to consider. And does it seem very clear to you why other regions have run with curbside charging and we haven't? Are we on our way to get more curbside charging, or like, do we not necessarily have the solution yet? What's standing in the way? Because it seems to me like this is a great idea.
Yeah. So I can tell you where I started that in 2015, the city of Vancouver was looking at how they can get more curbside charging or public level two charging installed for garage orphans. And a garage orphan is someone who has an electric car but doesn't have anywhere to park it or charge it at home. So that was an issue for Vancouver for like 5% or 6% of the population. Mm-hmm. So they were concerned about those people. Okay. And they came to a Vancouver Electric Vehicle Association meeting that I was attending. And I said, well, why don't we just use the streetlight infrastructure? And they said, well, that would only be level one. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think we can do level two on those. And everyone else in the audience felt that it couldn't be done. I said, okay, me being a researcher, let me go figure this out, and because I think it can be done. And so I went and found some grant money to figure it out, and went to Add Energy, which builds the hardware for the Flow network, mm-hmm. That people are familiar with. And they also said, we looked at that and it won't work. But with a bit of convincing, they said, well, let us try and we can show people why it doesn't work then. And they said, okay, yeah, that sounds good. We'll do that. And so they became a project partner in this cool. venture. And we went and deployed 10 level two chargers at curbside in the city of New Westminster in BC. And so the first thing we had to do was go and figure out, well, how do we get the power to the curbside? And we decided to use street lights. So we'd mount the chargers right on the pole. And then I was told that we could get 240 volts from the street light infrastructure, because when they run the power for the street lights, they run three wires, line one, line two, and a neutral. Mm-hmm. And they pull all three wires down the conduit between all the street lights. And each street light would just be connected to one line and one neutral, and that would give you 120 volts. But when you connect line to line, that's 240 volts. So the 240 volts was always available at each pole. And then we measured how much power was available on the circuits. And with the old incandescent kind of fixtures that they had on the streetlights, they were using about 12 amps of power on each line. And so we part of our project, we said, well, if we upgrade to LED lighting, we will save a bunch of energy and give us more power for installing the chargers. And so we did that, and we bought 120 volt LED fixtures for the city of New Westminster. Mm. And that freed up enough power on the system for us to run the chargers. The actual amperage on the circuits went down to 3 amps per circuit. And so the next thing that we were looking at was, well, if we didn't have enough power to run them, the full 32 amp chargers, we would have to use energy management to manage it. And we did that in some locations so that it would share the power with the lights. So when the street lights came on, instead of being able to get 32 amps, we would only offer 28 amps, and the other 4 amps was available for the street lights, which was down to 3 amps. So we were still within our limits. But then when the street lights went off for the day, the EV chargers would ramp up a little bit. And then we did do energy management where we would put 2 chargers on each street light, and then we would basically give 16 amps to each car when there's 2 cars, and when there's only 1 car, it would give the full 32 amps. And yes, we see that curbside charging example. So we had to worry about where the light poles were, and to make sure that two cars could park there and both cars could get their charging port connected to the cable that was hanging off the pole. So that was an obstacle that when we're looking for good locations, that not always were the poles aligned well with how the parking was going to work in that area.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting consideration. I mean, what a cool project. And if you're tuning in just in your ears for the podcast, I suggest you come over to YouTube to see. Kelly has provided me with this whole presentation PowerPoint of all the research so you can have some visual aids. But, you know, there's a lot of things to consider with curbside charging. And it sounds like you found a really cool solution. And I've even heard that, like, people want their streetlights to be converted to LED for whatever reason, like better safety, as long as they're not like bright white lights that disturb people at night. But it seems like that was a cool idea. You saw that there was, okay, there actually is power here. And if we just change a little thing here and there, we're able to take advantage of a couple different opportunities to provide this curbside EV charging. But then we get into the question of, like you said, like city planning, basically, where meters are, where street lamps are, and are our cities set up for curbside charging to begin with? Are there, I mean, I have a question for you, like, is there any places where it's just like, absolutely, you know, you can't, it's not going to work here? Or could you try to find a situation that would work? Actually, before we get to that, with this, you know, this idea where you connected all these street lamps and then you had the charging, what kind of, what would that cost?
Well, the cost was quite minimal because we didn't have to do any wiring as far as pulling new cables. We just had to attach the charger to a pole and drill a hole into the pole to run the power into the street lamp and run it down to the base where you could hook up the 240 volt connections.
Okay.
So it was much cheaper to deploy that way. There was also an issue of who owns the streetlights and who provides the power for the streetlights. So we chose New Westminster because the city was their own utility. So we didn't have to work with the city and a utility. We just went to the city and they just said, yeah, we like this idea, and sent us to their utility department, who again said, everybody always says, oh, you can't do it, it won't work. And so we had to explain that, yes, we knew what we were talking about and how it would work. But they were happy with the solution once it was done, and we showed that, yes, they can do it. And so because the city owns the utility, they could do it without having to add a metering system onto the EV charger. Because normally streetlights are not metered because they would just go to the utility and say, we have 7,000 of these lights. And because that would come on at night, and they would automatically know how much to bill for those streetlights because they have a statistical average of how many hours per day that those lights would be on and how much energy would consume.
Interesting. That's an interesting aspect, is how the utility gets involved, because obviously DC fast charging puts a huge pressure on the grid. You're pulling so much energy at one time. We've talked about this before. This is where the question comes from of, like, you know, how is our grid going to be able to handle that? But when we think about level 2 charging, do we have that same consideration? How is the grid going to handle this introduction of this kind of charging, this pull of energy from the grid? Is it the same kind of concern that we have with DC?
It's not the same kind of concern. There are some concerns. When we deploy it on the streetlights, there is a limit to how many of the poles we can put the level 2 chargers on, because normally there's a transformer that would then feed a panel, which would then feed 2 blocks worth of lights. So we could easily do 2 or 4 level 2 chargers in that 2 blocks, but we couldn't do every street light in the 2 block range without having to do additional work.
Okay. So spacing it out, making sure that it's not too much of a pull on in a certain area that would cause some headaches.
The other issue that is important for people looking at this is that you would want to install them close to the transformer. We had one location that we thought the transformer was directly across the street. And when we went and installed it, they turned off the circuit breaker, and the pole that we were at didn't get turned off. So they had to go figure out where it was actually being fed from, and which was a lot further away. Now, most cars were fine with it. There was a voltage drop, so there was 240 volt circuit, and it was drawing the voltage was 225 volts because it was at the very end of the run of two block. So that's a long distance for a low voltage, like a 240 volt cable. And I think it was Tesla's would treat it slightly different, and what they were tripping the circuit breaker, and so we had to turn down the amount of power that they would get because of the Teslas treating it differently, thinking it was more like a 208, a high voltage on a 208 line versus a low voltage on a 240, and so they would draw up more current. That was the only issue that we ever found in this deployment.
So the Tesla was communicating something that wasn't really working with the system with which it was plugged in, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they think they were drawing 32 amps, but instead of treating it as amps and volts, they were treating it as watts. And so because of that translation and thinking about things as watts, then it got confused because of the voltage drop and not being what they were expecting.
So you had to investigate that a little bit and see that this is to a specific, car, to a specific automaker and brand, but that you had to manage it across systems because it didn't know who was plugging in, right? And it couldn't be like, well, this is a Tesla. So yeah, it's not that complex of a system.
That's right.
Okay, cool. Okay. So then, so it's a different concern for sure, but there's still like some load balancing that's going on, right? And some, managing peak demand, like you're saying, there's ways to optimize it. And it starts to make me think about just the with the city planning basically, and how we're going to be able to implement this into the future. So how do we approach it if we're going to, there's startups like It's Electric who has been on the podcast that is, they're taking energy from a nearby building. So it's not street posts, but they're putting in these pedestals and then you have your plug-in cord. And so that seems to kind of navigate some things where it's like, okay, it doesn't matter where the street lamp is or where the meter is, we'll put it in where it's available as long as we have the power from a nearby building. So do you think it's working with the city planning or working around the city planning, and then hopefully city planners in the future will continue to design places that are more compatible with public EV level 2 charging?
Yeah, we definitely want city planners to be aware of these concerns and to design new development areas with this in mind, that you would want to have EV charging at the curb, especially when there's higher density and expecting parking on the curb, since everyone eventually will be in an electric car. So we want to make the city planners aware of what ways have been done so far that are not really conducive to EV charging. Using the power from nearby buildings is okay for now, but I would want to avoid that for the future because there's all these issues of if someone wants to dig up the sidewalk and they're not aware that there's now power lines running from the building to the curbside, that needs to be kept up to date with the city, and we'll have to worry about that happening.
So I'm sure you've learned from your research, the best ways to work with all the different stakeholders that are involved. What have you found, like what are the lessons that you're taking away? Because you say, yeah, I hope that our city planners go ahead and that they keep this in mind going forward because of the solutions that are best. How do you involve all of them effectively enough, not only from the community to the city planners, to the utility, to y'all doing the research, who all is involved and how do you keep them involved?
Yeah, so we've definitely made a big splash in 2016 when we actually deployed this, because everyone thought it was impossible to do, first of all. And then we did that presentation that you had brought
and
up.
We did a lot of, as we call it, the dog and pony show of going to all these different events, and we included BuildX and different events that were designed for city planners and the developers and those types of people, so they all got to learn about what it is that we were doing and what they needed to keep in mind for doing this in the future.
Okay. Do you feel like that has been considered and kind of adopted? Have you seen it, your research been used in other places to kind of inform?
Yeah. So after we did this deployment, we made some videos on YouTube for this infrastructure. And 6 months later, I got this message from AdEnergy that they had just signed the big deal with the city of Los Angeles the lights and power. We're deploying 800 charging stations using this new hardware that AdEnergy had made available to us for this research. And so Los Angeles was the first to do a big deployment of curbside charging using this street light and upgrading to LED lights was the keys that they took away from this.
I'm not surprised that it was California.
And I saw one of the podcasts that you guys did about similar things going on in New York City, and that was with AdEnergy/Flow as well. So I'm glad to see that they're continuing with this concept of the curbside charging. And each city was doing it slightly different. New York, they were putting in their own posts so that they could make them aligned with where the cars are going to be parked, which was one of the concerns about using the streetlights directly.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it seems like there are some cool ways to go about it. You've proven it, that it's possible. Other startups are proving that there are different kind of models that will make this work, because we will need, I mean, millions of these to, you know, that's what they're projecting. Research is projecting, you know, with 20 to 30 to 40 million cars, EVs on the road by 2030, 2040. We're going to need a lot of level two charging. Do you think we're pacing with that?
I don't think we're pacing with that yet, but I'm hopeful that we'll get there.
Me too. Definitely hopeful that we'll get there. And it seems like research like this, proven cases that this can be employed and that it's actually maybe not too expensive. It can be an improvement. It can, you know, a lot of people are saying this is not an amenity. This is an essential aspect of the places that you live or the places that you park. So I'd love to see the basically everyone who's in charge of this kind of effort, whether you're running like a multi-unit housing or whatever it is, but value level two charging. And I know in states where there's a high number of EVs on the road, it's value, you know, for sure. But we need it. There's not that kind of same pressure across the 50 states, you know, across all the provinces in Canada. But it seems like there are also regions in Europe that we can look to and say, okay, it might not work exactly like that, but we can adopt a lot of these things. Do we see regulation and policy pushing anything interesting in the level two space that you've seen recently?
Well, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about that. I haven't seen anything on policy for, at least for curbside charging. There's lots of policy about getting every parking stall in condos to be energized. In British Columbia, we have all sorts of requirements. So new buildings have to have EV charging stalls ready. Doesn't have to have the EV charger on the wall, but every stall has to have the electrical infrastructure in place, along with the power for air conditioning. So in the Lower Mainland, Vancouver area, doesn't get hot very often, but it does sometimes. And so air conditioning is becoming more of an issue for us with climate change. So installing heat pumps and level two charging are now kind of lumped together. You have to be considering both at the same time and making sure the building has electrical capacity for both. So that's happening now. And so when you look at getting EV charging, you also get an analysis for installing heat pumps for the Stratas.
Huh. Interesting. Just coupling those together. Which yeah. seems like a bit of a opportunity. Sure, you can do it at the same time, right? Considering similar aspects, but also a challenge. I mean, it's two projects versus one.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, so it's definitely two projects for doing the install, but the electrical capacity side, you had to do the electrical capacity planning, which has to take account for both.
Yes, definitely. So in terms of, I mean, I know that a lot of people will kind of equate this change for EV charging to air conditioning, right? When we added air conditioning all across the grid, like how is the grid going to be able to handle this? It does now. Is this like another level yeah. on top of air conditioning, or, you know, the heat pumps can be more efficient. So does it kind of balance it out going heat pumps, adding level two charging?
It doesn't balance it out. It'll basically mean more electricity usage, and it will push more energy managed level two charging for condos and multifamily buildings.
Okay. Interesting. I'd love to know what our audience, you know, what y'all have seen about curbside charging that you was surprising. Cause I feel like sometimes people just might pull up somewhere and they're like, wow, this is a charging model I haven't seen before. I'll plug in, see how easy this is. Yeah. I'd love to hear about that. And then of course, as we look into the, you know, the future, the bigger picture, we have mostly CCS charging. Of course, there is the J3400 North American Charging Standard Tesla Supercharger Network that is now opening up to automakers. Ford and Rivian are able to access it. And then a lot of CCS charge point operators will be retrofitting or building new stations that have the J3400 connector. So when we're talking about these cables, like if I have a cable, before we got on the call, we were talking about like, what is the future there? If I have my own cable, what does this mean? How will the technology and how it's advancing provide even more opportunities for me as an EV driver to, I don't know, access energy, to provide access to other EV drivers of my energy, of my battery on four wheels? Can you tell me a little bit more about what we were speaking about earlier? Because I think this is a pretty cool topic.
Sure. So I think we haven't told them really that. So with the J3400 in for North America, it has been already approved that they will support the model that we have now with the J1772, where the cable is attached to the level two charger, but they also support a socket model, which is what is used in Europe for their curbside charging. So we will see the NACS, the J3400 connector, being deployed for public level two charging, where you bring your own cable, which has the J3400 and to whatever connectors in your car, which in a couple of years will basically be the J3400 on every vehicle, every new vehicle anyway. Mm-hmm. So at bringing your own cable, you will see the J3400 to J3400 6 or 10 foot cable. Now that you have that in your trunk of your car for when you want to do curbside charging, well, what if you want to supply energy to another vehicle that's ran out of electricity on the road? So I expect to see that a software update from Tesla will say, turn my car into a charging station, and then you plug the J3400 into your charging port and plug the other end of the cable into the car that's broken or run out of energy on the road, and you can charge them up with a couple kilowatt hours so that they can limp along to get to the real charging station.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. An EV jumper cable is how yeah. we can think of it a little bit. And so that would be, we've talked about V to G, vehicle to grid. We've talked about V to X, vehicle to everything, where this energy is coming from the vehicle, this battery on wheels, and going to another spot, right? Being transferred on other podcasts, not on this one yet. But this is vehicle to vehicle. Where are we in that space of the technology, like, would that be possible right now? Is like standardization still coming along? What about safety? Where
yeah.
are we?
So it's coming along. Ford is kind of showing this technology now, but they weren't doing it in a standardized way. But I expect that their 2025 Ford F-150 Lightning will kind of be moving into using the standardized protocols for doing doing this. I don't think there's a problem with safety. And the vehicles that don't do it now, but they offer like a 110 outlet on the vehicle as an accessory. They can run a level one currently. So it's kind of extending that. So instead of getting, 3 kilometers range an hour, giving someone power, you can get like 30 or 40 kilometers in an hour. So, 10 or 15 minutes helping someone out on the side of the road will get them to where they need to go.
That's nice. I would love, I was on the phone with Kyle just the other day, maybe it was yesterday, and they are doing range tests with all these EV trucks. And while they were driving back, and they have this like diesel generator charger that they're like playing with. Of course, there's so many things to play with. It's a little ironic having diesel power EV charger, but they passed someone, I can't remember what they were in, maybe it was an ID4 or an Audi, that was stranded on the side of the road. And they're like, well, we can take this generator to them and charge them up on the side of the road. But to be able to jump someone, I think that would be great. Like, take some of my power, we'll sit here for a minute, you can at least carry on to the next charger that has undoubtedly been built nearby, because the charging infrastructure has just expanded and is super reliable and everywhere. So I think that's a cool spot for us to be going. Are there any other like emerging technologies or concepts that could, in your opinion, in your, based on your research, that could potentially, redefine the future of EV charging at level two or level three? Just kidding, DC fast charging. And where do you see us going forward with this?
Yeah, so part of the curbside charging that we looked at was looking at energy management, and I expect that to roll out more into condos. And when you have a parking lot full of vehicles, we can look at V1G technologies, which is controlled charging. It doesn't make a lot of sense when all the cars are there to have one car charging and another car kind of discharging, trying to balance the grid when it's just going into the other car. So if we just control how much power the building is going to take from the grid, and if the utilities are moving into an area of utility controlled charging, and that's going to be a very interesting area where they can say, if you can stop charging for the next 4 hours, we will pay you $1 per kilowatt hour that you do not normally use at this time of day. With charging, and all of a sudden paying for this infrastructure being put into the buildings, all of a sudden it's now a net positive for the strata council. So it's no longer how are we going to fund this infrastructure, it's what are we going to do with all the money that we make from it?
Oh, that would be really cool. So are we seeing like evidence that that is happening, that utilities are going to go that way? Basically, I'm going to incentivize you to not use the energy by paying you not to use it based on your usage.
Yes. I've done several projects with our local utility to show that it's possible, and that we can make significant money off of the amount of revenue that they want to, or the cost that they want to pay us per kilowatt hour. And the reason they want to pay us a lot more than the 10 cents that we buy it for is because when they have to turn on a peaker plant, it costs $1 or $1.50 per kilowatt hour to generate the electricity on this peaker plant. And so if they can avoid turning that on, they can pay us like half of what they were going to have to pay to generate more electricity in peak periods.
So interesting and complex. I love to think about it. So obviously, level one, level two charging has a lot of potential to impact the grid positively, to kind of really redefine the way that we've been interacting with the electricity we get from the grid and our utilities. Yeah. And I'm really excited to see where utilities go in embracing, kind of what you're saying and chasing the research and implementing it and trying it and then being able to scale it. I think that's really interesting. Maybe on another podcast, we could dive into all the V2, V1 topics, because I think that one's really cool. Tons of potential. And automakers are like, we're going to make our EVs capable with V2G, V2V. And I'm like, okay, but they're not yet, right? We're still waiting on that. So we'll see. I would love to hear what our audience thinks about this topic of conversation. What makes you curious about level two charging, level, you know, these opportunities? Where do you see, oh my gosh, this is space that could totally be used? Or like, as Kelly saw, there's energy there that we can take advantage of, and let's do the research and see how we can do it. So we'd love to hear your input on this topic, this conversation with Kelly. And thank you, Kelly, so much for, again, coming onto the podcast to speak about level two EV charging. I think this is a really cool topic. Like the numbers show, we need so much more of it. And there's a lot of examples to pull from, a lot of research and case studies that we can take inspiration from. And hopefully we'll see more and more of this in cities so that we can have easy charging when EVs are just parked.
Thanks, Francie.
We'll see you next time on the next Out of Spec podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in with us today for another episode. Have a great rest of your day. Bye, y'all.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.